From PRI, Public Radio International in Los Angeles, I'm Tavis Smiley.
Oh, Lord, I'm running, running for freedom.
I look back at it now. When I was running down there in Mississippi with Stokely and Rapp, and I knew I would be killed.
This tall, white guy looked at me, and he said, oh, there must be some mistake. We don't take colored in our school.
Believe it or not, there was a sizable minority of white people here in Montgomery, Alabama, who were very supportive of the kind of things we were doing and behind the scenes did everything they could to help out the bus boycott.
In this hour, we'll hear some of the personal, poignant, sometimes painful yet powerful memories of the civil rights movement from a few of the men and women who served on the front lines or played a vital role behind the scenes. For each person, it was a time that would change their lives forever. From PRI, Public Radio International, I'm Tavis Smiley. Today we're broadcasting a special program we've called Memories of the Movement, a collection of personal and poignant stories and reflections from icons of the civil rights movement.
Oh, Mary, don't you weep, don't you mourn. Pharaoh's army got drowned. Oh, Mary, don't you weep.
Moses stood on the Red Sea shore, spoke in the water with a 2x4.
Alabama native and now president of the University of Maryland, Baltimore County, mathematics professor Dr. Freeman Hrabowski recounts the many civil rights meetings led by Dr. King he attended as a child, and how eventually he found the solution to balance the equation of racial equality and integration. The epiphany led to his becoming a child leader in the movement, sometimes resulting in his arrest days at a time.
I remember the early 60s as a time of both turmoil and of hope. I especially remember as a child in 1963, I was 12, being forced to go to church during the week to the meetings of the Alabama Christian Movement. And Reverend Shuttlesworth would talk, and Dr. King would talk. And I really didn't want to be there, except I began to enjoy the music. And you can just hear people singing, ain't gonna let nobody turn me around. And woke up this morning with my mind set on freedom. And so what was interesting to me, though, is that I was doing homework. My cousin and I would be sitting in the back, and my parents would have us doing our homework, but they wanted us to be there to experience the movement, to hear the speakers, to listen to the music. And I was always someone who loved math, and so I always connect math to the movement and remembering, just as I do, solving math problems, halfway listening to what they were saying, being intrigued by some things. But I'll never forget when one of the speakers said children should be able to go to any school they wish and that our children need to have the best schools. And I started thinking, I wonder what it would be like to be in class with white kids, because I think I could make an A. And I just connect solving math problems, thinking about the possibility of being able to go to different schools, and listening to very inspiring speakers talk about the possibilities. And as a mathematician, I connect the math to the possibilities and to the notion of mathematics, quite frankly, as a civil right. The ability of people to solve math problems is a right that every child should have. I remember so well being told that I would be leading a group of children in the demonstration from the church, in the march from the church in the early 60s and 63. I think it was in May of 63. And moving from the church, walking to the city hall steps, and I was a fat little kid who simply loved math. I always did. I wasn't courageous, but I was fascinated by the notion that we could drink out of water fountains and go in any store and go to the movies. And Dr. King had said we had those rights as Americans, and I believed that. And so I remember leading this group of children and leading the songs, and I don't have a voice, but everybody was inspiring, and we would sing. I ain't gonna let nobody turn me round, turn me round, turn me round. I ain't gonna let nobody turn me round. Keep on walking, keep on talking, marching on to freedom land.
Ain't gonna let segregation, Lord, turn me round, turn me round, turn me round.
And the singing and the music inspired us and helped us deal with the fear of the dogs and the fire hoses and the policemen, and it just pushed us on. And I'll never forget once being in jail, being so lonely and so worried and so frightened and trying to keep the kids I was responsible for, who were younger than I was 12, keeping them fairly calm as they cried and cried, "I want my mama." And it was just so difficult. And at some point, after several days, all the kids were gathered at the windows and all of our parents were on the outside. And Dr. King was there to speak to the children. And he said something that I will never forget. He said, "What you do this day will have an impact on children yet unborn." And there was this incredible pause. And all of a sudden, we were all elevated. And we didn't even understand it, but we knew it was important. We knew we were making a difference. And I'll always remember his words, because what it said to me was that even children can make hard decisions that can have a major impact on the lives of other people. And it was our right to demonstrate and our right to believe in our future.
Go down, Moses, way down in Egypt's land. Tell old Pharaoh to let my people.
Legendary actor Danny Glover has traced his own emergence as an activist to bearing witness to some of the pivotal events of the Civil Rights Movement.
When I think about the Civil Rights Movement, it's how I interpreted it as a child, as I saw men and women become the architects of their own history and who made history. I wanted to emulate them. But also, from my vantage point, seeing it on television, for the first time, television meant something for me. When, as I saw it on television, I was also reminded of my parents and how they interpreted the movement itself and how it affected them, how it energized them. It was almost like a family affair that we would turn on the news at a certain time during the day to look at what has happened in anticipation about what was happening during the Montgomery bus boycott, what was happening during the various marches in Selma and Mobile and in Montgomery, Alabama. All those things were important. More importantly, also was the fact that those young men and women who were part of the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee weren't too much older than I was. So I wanted to be like them and wanted to emulate them. But tragically, one of the moments that I remember and that stands out in my mind was the bombing of the 16th Avenue Baptist Church in September of 1963 in Birmingham, Alabama. I've always remembered that. And those young girls who died that day, Addie Mae Collins, who was 15, and Denise McNair, who was 11, and Carol Robinson, 14, and Cynthia Wesley as well. I'll remember that forever. I remember that moment more than any moment, even though, you know, we had a number of things happen in 1963, the assassination of John F. Kennedy in November. But that moment in the Civil Rights Movement will always stick out for me.
The church, it was crowded and no one could see that Cynthia Wesley's dark number was 3. Her prayers and her feelings would shame you and me. And the choir kept singing of freedom.
Congresswoman Eleanor Holmes Norton recalls some of the most turbulent days of the movement, working in Mississippi as a young law student and member of the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, SNCC.
These memories conflate because they begin with Medgar Evers and Jackson trying to convince me to stay there because the sit-ins in 63, long after the sit-ins had happened elsewhere, had resulted in great violence. And here I was a law student, very few lawyers. And I said, no, I promised Bob Moses I would go to the Delta, to Greenwood. So he put me on a bus to Greenwood. And there began maybe the most concentrated 2 or 3 days of my life. When I got to Greenwood, took me to a late at night. They took me to a family where I was to spend the night. I was sitting in a. They obviously had no electricity and or no facilities. They had electricity, and they had gone out to pick whatever they picked, and they told me how to take a bath. So for the first time in my life, I was sitting in a wash tub taking a bath. When a youngster came to the door and said, Mega Evers has just been shot and killed. He went home from having put me on a Greyhound bus and in his driveway was shot. And at the same time, Fannie Lou Hamer was being held in jail. And the only person of any age there, also a student, Lawrence Guyot, had gone to get her and he was being held in jail. And so what amounted to a bunch of teenagers in SNCC came and said, yes, we got to go and sing. And we sang and prayed about Mega, but now we've got Fannie Lou Hamer in jail. What are we going to do? And we've got one of our people already jailed. And so I did what, interestingly, lawyers did. I interrogated them. Tell me everything you know about here, about there. It was Winona, Mississippi. Because I know I have to go, and obviously I didn't want to get beat too, but I couldn't just say I wasn't going. And one of the things they told me was that the police chief in Greenwood, while, as it were, one of them was not violent, was not with the white citizen councils when they drove around the office every night, and was, all things considered, a decent person. So guess what? In the midst of this crisis, and this all happened within a very few days, I went to see the police chief. I said, my name is Eleanor Catherine Holmes. I go, I'm from Washington, D.C. I go to Yale Law School. I'm about to go over to Winona, Mississippi to get Ms. Hamer and the others out of jail. Lawrence Guyot has just been jailed. I didn't know what had happened to him. And so I've called everybody to tell him I'm going. I'm just asking you to call the Winona police chief and tell him what I told you, because I got to go. He listened to me, and he said, I'll call him. He was very deliberative. So we drove over there. And I walked in and asked to see Ms. Hamer and Lawrence Guyot. And sure enough, they took us to see him. And Lawrence Guyot couldn't see me right away because they had put him out to the white citizens' councils at night, beat him so bad that he didn't have any clothes on. So he had to put some clothes on until he could see me. Ms. Hamer had been visibly beat by a black trustee who was told, you beat her or you get beat. And I was able, without being jailed, to talk with them, to interrogate them, to then later arrange for them to be released. Within 2 or 3 days of my life, I had seen what people perhaps don't see in a lifetime.
Oh, freedom. Oh, freedom. Oh, freedom over me. And before I'd be a slave, I'd be buried in my grave and go home to my Lord and be free. Everybody.
You're listening to Memories of the Movement.
Well, will you go back again? Certainly not. Well, will you go back again? Certainly. Well, will you go back again? Certainly, Lord. Certainly, 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 Lord.
Reverend Jesse Jackson Sr. remembers the chain of events that would launch his lifelong career as a civil rights leader.
Jimmie Lee Jackson was killed in the Black Belt of Alabama. The students who were with him said maybe a reaction to it should be, let's march across the Independence Bridge to Selma, Alabama. I mean to Montgomery, Alabama. It met great resistance. The whole idea of marching was a reaction to his getting killed. The Sunday that the march took place, there were no doctors or PhDs or lawyers or judges or celebrities or ministers of major churches on the bridge that Sunday. The two most known people were John Lewis and Jose Williams. And the riotous attack, and the blood drawn, and the scenes drew great attention. Dr. King was contacted while in his pulpit in church that Sunday. He could have explained it with Selma, Alabama. The point there is that Mrs. Boynton, in whose home he stayed in Selma, Mrs. Foster, Reverend Reed, Reverend Anderson, those persons would never achieved celebrity. It was on their sacrifice and really their judgment to march and their courage to march out of which came the scene that laid the groundwork or the framework for the Voting Rights Act. It was Reverend C.T. Vivian who was hit in the mouth by Jim Clark, the sheriff in Selma, that picture shot around the world. Those persons with raw courage and sacrifice must always be revered and honored. And those who come after to celebrate their sacrifice must do so with awe and respect and trembling. So I remember that moment stands out. I was in seminary, and I was trying to not go back south for a moment to study. And I left and took 3 carloads of seminarians from Chicago to Selma. That's when I began working with Dr. King officially. And while I was there, Jesse Jr. was born. I got the way he was born. I almost named him Selma. He refused to forgive me for the very thought of having naming him Selma. I knew it was a big moment in history, and I was one to connect it to the historical bit. But whenever March 11th is his birthday, it's always Selma, you know, time again. That stands out of my mind as one of those big moments. In October of 1959, Jackie Robinson came to Greenville, South Carolina to speak for the state NAACP. And they took him back to the airport. They had a color and white section. Reverend Mrs. Hall took him back. And Mrs. Hall sat in the white section. And while Jack Robinson was getting his ticket, police came to arrest her, and her husband, Reverend Hall, stood with her. Jack Robinson then showed up and said, "This is not resolved. I will not leave." And it was resolved. But based upon that protest about sitting in the airport, Reverend Hall then organized a march January the 1st, because that is historically celebrated as Emancipation Day, January 1st, 1863. That march took place about 1,500 people on Sunday, January the 1st. The sit-ins took place in Greensboro, February the 1st, a month later. I was a member of that church, a student. I was born into that church, as a matter of fact, Springfield Baptist Church. That summer when I came back home from school and had been denied the right to use the public library, Reverend Hall sent 8 of us to open the public library. We were arrested July 16, 1960. And so part of what's not commenting on is Reverend James Hall in Greenville, South Carolina, in protesting the denial of Jackie Robinson's right to use the facility to trigger this huge demonstration January 1st, 1860, on Emancipation Day, a month before the Greensboro sit-in. And 7 months later, I, along with 7 students, was jailed. Arguably, my public career as an activist was initiated at that time. I met Dr. King 5 years later. Reverend James Hall was now pastor of Triumph Baptist Church in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. He was a huge force for social justice.
I was born by the river in a little tent. Oh, and just like the river, I've been running ever since. It's been a long time coming, but I know
Dr. Ray Richardson is the owner of Marcus Books in San Francisco, the nation's oldest and longest surviving black bookstore. That period of racial segregation taught her one of life's greatest lessons.
My husband was stationed in New Guinea. Oh, it was probably 44, 43 or 44. I decided to go back to school, and I'd always wanted to be a fashion designer. And there was a renowned one on Venice Street. And so I sent in an application with my money, and I was accepted. There was a lovely old white elevator operator. He was just a very sweet, sweet man. And we talked, and, you know, I told him about my husband was in service. And he said, "You're going to school?" And I said, "Yes." And he wished me luck. And got off the elevator, and I walked into that office. And this tall, white guy looked at me and asked me what I wanted. And I told him I had come for the first day of school. And he said, "Oh, there must be some mistake. We don't take colored in our school." And I was crushed. Because even when I went to Tuskegee in Alabama, I never had that kind of confrontation. And I didn't know how to handle it. And so I got back on the elevator, and I was just crying. And this kindly old man, when I told him what had happened, he was so angry. He said, "Those lousy sons of bitches, your husband is over there fighting for their right to do this to you." He was so angry. And he put his arm around me, and he consoled me. And then I went home, and I thought about him. And I wondered, as old as he was, how had he not known that this existed? And even if he didn't participate in it, he had to approve it because he didn't fight it. And I don't believe in the concept of innocence. I believe we're all guilty. When I was a kid, there was a saying, "For every child, a tooth." When a woman was pregnant, she lost a tooth, or lost at least one tooth. And it was accepted as a consequence of pregnancy, and later it was found, of course, that that growth inside her, that baby, needs calcium to build bones and teeth. And if her diet does not furnish enough calcium, that baby takes from the mother. That's why she loses her tooth. Now, if innocence does not occur at that level, I don't think it ever occurs. I think we are complicit in what happens to us. If we accept it, we are guilty. If we fight it, we're still guilty because we're part of it. And that I've learned that over 86 years of living, that however passionate I am against something, if I don't fight it, I'm complicit in it.
Asian activist Yuri Koshiyama fought for human rights for all people right up to her death in June 2014 at the age of 93. In this clip, she recalls the fear and excitement she had the day that she met Malcolm X.
1963 was the year that the movement itself came up north. They were building a hospital in Brooklyn, but they weren't hiring any black or Puerto Ricans. And so I think it was CORE that organized a demonstration. It was in the summer of 1963, and every day they were going to demonstrate until they hired black and Puerto Ricans. And it was after the summer of 63 that all the people who were arrested, a few at a time, had to appear in court and all that. And one day, who should walk into the foyer of the courtroom but Malcolm X? And everybody was so excited, all the young black kids, and they all ran down to meet him, and they were shaking his hands and talking to him. But then, because I wasn't black, I didn't know if it would be right for me to go down there, because a month or so before, there was a white woman who went into Harlem to a restaurant where she saw Malcolm sitting and eating, and she went right to his table and said, "What can I do for you?" He looked at her and said, "Nothing." And she walked away crying. So then I thought of that, and I thought, oh, gee, I better not even try. But I saw it was mostly all the blacks that were there in court. I didn't know how I could meet him like everybody else was doing. And I asked the head of court, and he said, well, you could try. He could tell you to go away, or he could tell you you don't belong here. And gee, I thought, maybe some of the black people might feel offended that someone not black would be talking to the, I think at that time, he was the most well-known black person. But then more and more inside I wanted to, and someone came by and said, well, you could try and he could just tell you it's not for you, you know. And so I got closer and closer, and I thought, if he looks up once, I'm going to yell out, can I shake your hands too? All the rest of the people were doing that. And he did. There was a moment when he sort of looked up, maybe wondering why this older Japanese woman, oh, he didn't know it was Japanese, but an Asian person would be there. And when I said, can I shake your hand? And he said, what for? And I said, because I want to congratulate you. And he said, for what? And I said, for what you're doing for your people. And he said, and what am I doing for my people? I thought, what shall I answer? And I said, you're giving direction. And then he just changed, and he came out of that group where he was surrounded, and he put out his hand. So I rushed there, and I grabbed his hand. I couldn't believe I was shaking the hand of Malcolm X. I mean, you could imagine how, you know, famous he was. And so that's how we met.
James Kearney, a lifelong member of the NAACP, was 107 years old when he died in December of 2013. He was 2 years older than the NAACP itself. On the occasion of its centennial, when Kearney was 102, he gave us a firsthand look at the evolution of America's oldest civil rights organization.
Well, I can't think of his name. Down at Pastora, he was the head of our NAACP, and we all worked together. We'd have a Satan meeting, I think we once a month, I think it was, we met. And everyone that was in it was very concerned about the NAACP. Well, I see how they're treating us out on the farm and how they're in this little city that we'd go to at that time, Pine Bluff. They didn't recognize us very much as human beings. So we had a very good leader in the NAACP, and we all joined. It had 14 of us young boys join at the same time, and we all had a pretty good crowd of grown people in it, and they'd meet every 2 weeks. It was very important, and I thought a lot of the NAACP. And we were very helpful there in helping out our people. There in the schoolhouses, a lot of times they wouldn't give us good books. Then the NAACP had come in there and interfere with them. They get them to give us books. Most times the white ones would use the books. And then after they tear them up, then they bring them and give them to the black ones. And we had to speak for that.
Georgia Congressman John Lewis marched alongside Dr. King and many of the other heroes of the movement. Here he tells of the special significance the Voting Rights Act has for him in the new political landscape.
In 1961, the year that Barack Obama was born, we organized something called the Freedom Ride in Washington, D.C. During that year, it was impossible for blacks and whites to board a Greyhound bus or a Trailway bus and travel together from Washington through Virginia, through North Carolina, through South Carolina, through Georgia, through Alabama, Mississippi, into New Orleans without the possibility of being arrested or jailed or beaten. We saw those signs that said white waiting, white men, white women, colored women. We were arrested and jailed in Birmingham, beaten in Montgomery by an angry mob, later arrested in jail in Jackson, Mississippi. But the Freedom Rides of 1961 led to the desegregation of public transportation all across the South. Those signs came tumbling down. And those signs are gone. And the only place our children will see those signs today, all these years later, will be in a museum, on a video, or in a book. During those years, it was almost impossible for people of color to register to vote. People had to pass a so-called literacy test, pay a poll tax. Some people were asked to count the number of bubbles in a bar of soap, count the number of jelly beans in a jar. People marched. People were beaten. Some were jailed. Some were even killed. But we didn't give up. We didn't give in. We kept the faith, and we kept our eyes on the prize until the Congress passed the Voting Rights Act of 1965, and President Lyndon Johnson signed it into law on August 6, 1965. And because of that effort, we have witnessed what I like to call a nonviolent revolution in America.
Ooh, child, things are gonna get easier. Ooh, child, things will get brighter.
You're listening to Memories of the Movement from PRI, Public Radio International. I'm Tavis Smiley. I often say that life is not made up of the breaths we take, but of the moments that take our breath away. For those men and women who were part of the Civil Rights Movement, there were many such moments, and now we continue to share a few of those special stories and reflections that we've compiled in this special Memories of the Movement.
Keep your eyes on the prize. Hold on, why don't you hold on?
Well, the bonnet, bonnet, don't you?
Chicago Alderman Dorothy Tillman was a student organizer who worked closely with Dr. King. She recalls the climate that led her to become active in the Civil Rights Movement.
When I was a little girl growing up in the South, I could never sit on the front of the bus. And I always thought the bus was something magic. The front bus, it was like something very magic. All the little white kids, little white girls be on the front of the bus, very magical, waving. But I could never sit there. Even when my grandmother would carry me on Day Street, I took her to Day Street too, on Day Street and Greyhound, we would go and get on that bus, an all-black community now. We would get on this bus, and we could not get on. We put our money in the front, we'll walk to the back. We could not sit on the front of the bus. Then when the little white, we go to the white community, little white kids get on. Coming back, you still couldn't sit there. And I always tried to sit on the front of that bus, and my grandma would always pull me back. It was always humiliating to put the money and to go to the back. And I would always say, why? So one night, my grandmother carried me to the Holt Street Baptist Church, H-O-L-T Baptist Church. And that's when I met this man that changed my life forever. When he began to speak, he baptized my soul. I was 9 years old, and he talked about why this bus boycott was going on, why we had to fight. And I think at nine, I knew and I understood why Rosa Parks refused to give her seat up. That changed my life forever.
Reverend Robert Bratz explains how he became one of the first white Christian ministers associated with the civil rights movement. He also shares remembrances of his friendship with Rosa Parks and just how he found out she had been arrested.
Well, when we heard somebody had been arrested and there was a boycott plan, I knew that Mrs. Parks would know what was going on because she worked with the NAACP. And right across the street from our church, the NAACP Youth Council, which she headed, met in our church. So that was a logical person to call. And I called her up, and, "Ms. Parks, I understand that somebody's been arrested on the buses." "Yes, that's right, Pastor Gretz." "And we're supposed to have a boycott on Monday to protest that." "That's right, Pastor Gretz." "Do you know anything about it?" "Oh, yeah, Pastor Gretz." "Well, do you know who was arrested?" "Yes, Pastor Gretz." "Well, who was it?" "It was me, Pastor Gretz." She was not the kind of person to brag about what she was doing. She kept in the background. She was quiet, dignified, and yet full of courage. Well, I had a kind of a race relations experience when I was in college and first really learned how badly black people were being treated in this country. From that time on, we were totally involved. I joined the NAACP in 1948. Just involved ourselves in the black community. So for us, it was normal to be living in another black community. Believe it or not, there was a sizable minority of white people here in Montgomery, Alabama, who were very supportive of the kind of things we were doing and behind the scenes did everything they could to help out the bus boycott. Some active people, Clifford and Virginia Durr, white couple, people like that. On the other extreme, there were the Klan types, who hated us because if there was anything worse than an N, it was an N lover, and we were the N lovers.
So, Governor Wallace, oh yeah, you never can jail us all. Governor Wallace, yeah, segregation's bound to fall.
The legendary actor and activist Harry Belafonte was a close friend and confidant of Dr. King. In fact, he leveraged that relationship to bring Dr. King on The Tonight Show one night when he was guest hosting. Here, Mr. Belafonte tells the story of that memorable and poignant appearance.
By the time he went on air, Dr. King had not arrived, so he made quick adjustment to fill his slot and how he would cover the spot. About a quarter of the way into the show, Dr. King showed up so we could go back to Plan A. And when he came on air, he didn't give me a chance to do very much but hug him and greet him. And he sat and he said, "I must beg your forgiveness for the consternation and the cause of anxiety here." He said, "But I have had my own experience. I left Atlanta late. The plane was late. I got to the airport. I got into the cab. The driver recognized me. And he said, 'What are you doing in town?' And I told him that I was late coming for this broadcast with you. And all he had to hear was that I was late. And that man hit the gas and took me on a drive that was the most nervous experience of my life. He zoomed in and out of traffic. And I had to tap him on the shoulder and said, 'Sir, if you don't mind, I appreciate your sense of urgency, but I'd rather be known as Martin Luther King late than the late Martin Luther King.'" That was rebroadcast several times because I asked him, in fact, how did he feel about death? And did he fear for his life? And he took that moment to reveal for the first time before a large American audience that he had come to peace with the idea of death, that he really was not deeply distracted by about life as an experience of just the longevity. He was concerned about the quality of life and how he used it. And that fact stood indelibly in my mind because during the earlier years, he had developed a psychological tic. He constantly had occasion to go into hiccups, and he just silently. And I asked him about it. He just said, "I don't know, I just feel anxiety. And whenever I have anxiety, that comes about." And I noticed that over a number of days or weeks recently, that was no longer evident. And he said it was because he had come to peace with the issue of death.
Yeah. Ambassador Andrew Young remembers the ongoing struggles of the civil rights movement that were civic, legal, and physical in nature. He recounts for us his meetings with President Lyndon Johnson and the violent months leading up to Johnson's historic signing of the Civil Rights Act.
Let's start with December, coming back from the Nobel Prize, and going to see President Lyndon Johnson and him taking a whole hour to explain why he just got a Civil Rights Act passed in 64. He could not pass another Civil Rights Act in 1965. We sat there very politely and thanked the president. But when we got home, John Lewis and Amelia Boynton from Selma and Reverend Fred Reese were there. And they said, look, when they won't even let us have voter registration meetings, they won't let us walk down the street. If more than three black people are walking down the street together, they consider it a demonstration. If we go to the courthouse, they lock the door. It was against the law in Selma to have the Emancipation Day meeting on January 1st because of local ordinances preventing black people from doing anything political. So they said, Dr. King, you got to come there to help us. And there was no way we could say no to that. But as a result of that, and as a result of going there and marching from the 2nd of January right on through to the 7th of March, when on the way across the Edmund Pettus Bridge, everybody got beat up. And they got beat up on television. I mean, it was like nobody expected this to happen. We expected to get arrested. We expected to get turned around. But we didn't expect that they would ride us on horseback and tear gas people and beat them with billy clubs just for trying to walk from Selma to Montgomery. We went to court, but while we were there, well, Jimmie Lee Jackson was killed in Marion, Alabama. Reverend Reeb was killed in Selma. Viola Liuzzo was killed driving back from Montgomery. And it was almost as though President Johnson said, enough is enough. And he made that famous We Shall Overcome speech. And by August the 6th in 1965, after he told us just in December that there was no way a Civil Rights Act could be passed, he signed the Civil Rights Act into law.
Members of the Little Rock Nine who helped integrate Central High School, Elizabeth Eckford and the late Jefferson Thomas, shared memories of their contributions to the movement.
During the process of preparing us to go to Central, I heard all these comments about, you know, there might be violence, it might be this, all these possible things that could go wrong. And I listened, but I really didn't understand because I knew I had played with the white kids from Central. We played together after school, but the law said we didn't sit down next to each other in class. So, you know, I put up with that. When the law changed, I thought there would be no violence in going to Central. I really did not believe that all these grown folks knew what they were talking about. Even when the crowds formed, I thought if I can get past those grown-ups into Central with other teenagers, other intelligent human beings, everything would be quiet and peaceful, and we'd go about our business of getting an education. I really did not believe until maybe two or three weeks into it, it occurred to me that this isn't getting any better. I was sort of stuck then. I thought about quitting, and I actually wanted to, but I didn't want to back out on my family because I had gotten them involved in this. And we had a little meeting and discussion, and my dad said he really wanted me to finish because I had started it.
We had a regular routine. This was going to be the first day of school. I was a very shy kid going to a really big school. My concerns were getting lost in the school. But I felt a little bit reassured because a lot of my neighbors that I'd known for 8 years went to Central, and I expected to see some familiar faces. I knew that the governor had called out the Arkansas National Guard, but I expected that the Guard were there to protect all students. Mm-hmm. So I rode the bus to within two blocks of the school. The neighborhood was very, very familiar to me because I had passed it going to junior high school and then high school. I was entering the 11th grade. I noticed that there were more cars parked than usual. I could hear the murmur of a crowd. As I approached the corner of 14th and Park, I saw the Arkansas National Guardsmen break ranks to admit students. I didn't know that that day they turned away all Negroes, even the cafeteria workers and the janitors. I made three attempts to pass through the line. At the third attempt, a soldier directed me across the street where there were angry people. When I stepped off the curb, they fell in behind me and they were screaming and shouting. I couldn't go back in the direction I had come, but I knew there was another bus stop at the end of that two-block area. And so I just simply fastened on the thought of getting to that bus stop. It meant safety for me. It sounds ridiculous now, but that's what made me keep putting one foot in front of the other. I knew I could not turn around.
I'm on my way.
Comedian Dick Gregory recalls that the extraordinary vision and courage of the young men and women who helped change the world was no joke.
It's hard to believe that Dr. King was recruited into the civil rights movement with no prior training, not part of a human rights, not part of a civil rights. He was recruited in 1956. He was assassinated in 1968. It is hard when you reflect back that one person with the help of organizations could have such a profound effect on the world in 12 years. I was there. It's kind of unbelievable that that was just 12 years. And one of the cute things you hear people talking about today, where are the young people? You know, that's a myth. King was 26 years old when he stepped into that movement. Andy Young was 30. I was 31. Abernathy was getting old age pension. Reverend Shuttlesworth. So where is this myth about we will find a cure for cancer? It won't be from no 18-year-olds. That is nothing but a cheap cop-out for the older folks not to want to do nothing and reach back and wonder what have happened to the children. Why are they not there? And I never knew I would see the day that I could sit and say to the world, because of that movement and because of King, that I would feel more comfortable today being killed by someone than killing someone. And so when I reach back and look at the fondness of that movement, and we got to also remember the strongest two forces in the history of America has always been the black woman and the black church. You know, 98% of the people in the forefront of that movement in the 50s and 60s had Reverend in front of their name before they had PhD. When one day a racist, sexist nation like this, who controls the press and the airways, one day when unborn black folks and white folks, just not even born, will be born with no hidden agendas for the first time, the world will find out the true meaning of that movement. I look back at it now. When I was running down there in Mississippi with Stokely and Rapp and now Congressman John Lewis, I knew I would be killed. I kissed my wife and family goodbye. Sometime I carried her with me. King was saying, don't fight. Don't be angry. Be lovable. Be kind. And I'm saying, wait a minute. How you tell me to love my enemy? How you tell me don't have no hatred when I'm looking at what they're doing? Well, let me tell you, no movement in the history of this planet, even the ones with guns, have ever made the progress that African Americans have made in a 40-year period in spite of black folks and white folks lying to one another.
From PRI, Public Radio International, I'm Tavis Smiley. It was one of the most volatile yet vibrant times in American history. Meetings and marches, speeches and protests for change. Today, memories of the movement. We lost an icon of both the entertainment world and the civil rights movement in 2014 with the passing of Ruby Dee. In this clip, she recalls the abiding friendship she and her husband, the late Ossie Davis, had with Malcolm X and how he became a major part of their lives.
When I think about Malcolm, my brother had introduced us to Malcolm. We'd heard a lot about him. And like Martin, when I first went to see him, I thought this was the pre-speaker. And I thought, this guy's talking such a long time. And so when it was all over, I was impressed by what he was saying. And so when I went up to him, to this tall, gangly man, and there was a kind of what I call a wiggly twinkle around his mouth and in his eyes. And so I said, oh, my goodness. I said, oh, you're Malcolm. I had no reverence at the moment. I let him know that he was repeating himself a lot. He said, well, you got to say things over and over so it'll sink in. And he laughed. And from that moment, Ossie and Malcolm and a whole group of us came together. And then we decided that we had to let the people we know Malcolm. So I had a party at my house. I lived in Mount Vernon then. And invited Malcolm. And in those days, we weren't doing cameras because it was McCarthyism. So we weren't taking pictures. And a lot of our, I think, people from the American Negro Theater came, and Sidney came, and Alice Childress, and everybody was so excited to meet Malcolm. And we didn't smoke. I said, well, we can't smoke because Malcolm doesn't smoke. There was such an aura around him. If Malcolm, if he wasn't drinking at that time, nobody drank because Ossie and I made sure that nothing happened of which he would not approve, because that's how much we respected his potential as a leader. And I just have to tell you about the time between Malcolm and King. They were kindred spirits. And during the March on Washington, Ossie and I were up in a hotel room, and who should come knocking at our door by himself but Malcolm? And nobody had expected Malcolm to be there. As a matter of fact, I got the feeling that they didn't really want Malcolm to come to that 63 march. And Malcolm, he sat us down, and he told us, he says, I just want you to know that I'm here. I don't want anybody to, you know. In case anything goes down, he wanted us to know that don't let anything go down that he could help with or prevent or something like that. And then he left. He told Ossie how to get in touch with him, told him and him alone how to get in touch with him should an emergency arise there in Washington. And I got goose pimples, you know, after the visit. And, of course, it all went smoothly. But they hadn't even met then, I don't think, King and Malcolm. But Malcolm had once told us, he said, he was going to be backup for King. He said, deal with him or you're going to have to deal with us. In other words, he was putting his strategy second to what King was doing. But he said it publicly, too. Malcolm, at the end, was a hunted and a haunted man, running, running, running for his life. His home firebombed, his wife and his children stranded in Queens at my brother's house. Still, he was not deterred from his main objective, that is, to bridge the gap between him and the rest of the civil rights movement, with an organization that would give him a broader base from which to operate, the details of which he planned to unveil that Sunday afternoon at the Ottoman Ballroom, you know, where he was assassinated. And Malcolm had invited us and me, by the way, to the Ottoman that day. But we had a previous commitment downtown, something that Ron Bennett had to do with. And so we left the children in Harlem with my mother, and we honored our other agreement. But we wish we could have gone. And when we returned to pick them up, the kids told us that something had happened to Malcolm. And so we turned on the television as a bulletin interrupted the ballet. I never will forget this gorgeous little girls in tutus dancing and the announcement coming over here about Malcolm being shot and our whole anguish that morning of not being able to go because we knew that something imminent was going to happen. That very morning, by the way, when I got out of bed, I went into the bathroom, and I'm not a singer, but I found myself singing out of the clear blue sky, Another man done gone. Another man done gone. Like that. And I never sing like that. I don't sing like that. And I knew all the words. Looked like I knew all the words. I didn't know I knew all the words to that chant.
Another man done gone from the county farm. Another man done gone. I didn't know his name. I didn't know his name. I didn't know his name. I didn't know his name.
We travel to India, specifically 1959, when Dr. King went on a month-long trip to the land of Mahatma Gandhi. A longtime scholar of the Indian Revolution, Dr. King met with members of his family, laid a wreath at his grave, and even addressed the country on radio.
Since being in India, I am more convinced than ever before that the method of nonviolent resistance is the most potent weapon available to oppress people in their struggle for justice and human dignity.
As you can hear, it was Gandhi's principles of nonviolence and civil disobedience that most fascinated Dr. King, and this journey of discovery set the table for his I Have a Dream speech and the Nobel Peace Prize speech just a few years later. Arun Gandhi, the grandson of the Mahatma, he was working as a journalist in India during Dr. King's visit and later went on to found the Gandhi Institute for Nonviolence. He joins us from Mumbai, India.
What I remember most was when he came to Bombay. There is a house in the central part of the city which was used by my grandfather whenever he came to the city. And that place is now turned into a museum and a library. So Dr. King and his family and others who joined him all came there to that museum. The unique thing about this museum is that on the second floor they have a room which my grandfather used whenever he lived in that house. And that room is very sparsely furnished. There is literally no furniture, just a little mat in one corner on which he slept and went where he sat and worked. And nobody is allowed to enter the room, but you can look into the room through a glass panel. And when Dr. King came there and he looked into the room there, he felt that urge to go inside and sit and meditate for a little while. So he asked the director if he could get special permission to go inside. And because he was a guest of the government and a very important person, the director opened the room and allowed him to go in alone. So he went in and sat down and he dismissed the rest of the group and said that I'll join you whenever I'm ready. And then soon it was time for the museum to close and Dr. King was still not out of the room. So the director went to ask him when he was planning to leave because they wanted to close up and go home. And Dr. King shocked her by saying that he's not going anywhere. He's going to stay the night there. And the director was totally flabbergasted and she said, "How can you stay the night here? This is a museum. We don't have any facilities." And Dr. King said, "Well, I don't need all that. If Gandhi could live here, I can live here. If he could sleep on the floor, I can sleep on the floor. I'm not going anywhere. I'm staying here the night." So he spent the whole night there and came out the next day around 10 o'clock and he announced to the director and all the people who were there at the museum that now I feel morally strong enough to go back and lead my country.
Segregation alone, because they love segregation like a hound dog of a bone.
As Dr. King's personal attorney, Clarence Jones became a trusted confidant and a pivotal figure in the March on Washington when he originated the draft of Dr. King's historic I Have a Dream speech. But long before that, he recalls how he reluctantly joined the freedom movement at the behest of Dr. King.
I got a call from Dora from someone who said, "By the way, Dr. King is going to be speaking as a guest preacher in a church in Los Angeles, and he would like you and your wife to come and attend church." that I told my wife about, she says, well, at least if you're not going to go to Montgomery, you have no excuse not going to church. She was pregnant. She said, I don't think I want to go. You go. So I go to this church, and I listen to Dr. King. Now, that was the first mistake I made. First of all, he was very smart. This church was in West Los Angeles. That was the center of where the black intelligentsia, the lawyers, the entertainment, and so forth. And I'm sitting like 20th row center, and he starts preaching. And he says, sisters and brothers, ladies and gentlemen, the text of my sermon today is the role and responsibility of the Negro professional to the masses of our people. And then he started giving the most eloquent description of what he was doing in the South. And I thought to myself, now that's pretty smart, because he certainly did choose the right place to make this comment. Then he said, and for example, there's a young man sitting in this church today that the Lord tells me has touched his brain, that this young man is gifted and he can go in and he can do this. And I'm saying, well, I don't know who he's talking about. And then he said, I learned something about this young man. He lives in this nice fancy house, has a roof that opens up and a skylight comes in. He says, you know, and this young man told me that his mother was a maid and a cook and his father was a chauffeur and a gardener. And people like him, you know, they forget from whence they came. And he paused, never looked at me once. And then he said, this young man's the kind of person we need to have and be part of the movement. And when I said he forget from whence he came, he then started quoting Langston Hughes's poem, Life Ain't Been No Crystal Stair. And when he did, it was like I had a video picture of my mother. The poem is a story about a woman who was scrubbing stairs in a white folks' house. Tears start welling up in my eyes because I started having a vision of my mother, who had died just a few years earlier in 1952. This is 1960. And I was looking to see whether anybody could see me. At the end of the service, he's standing around outside the church making autographs. And there's like maybe 20 yards between us. And he looks up over at me as he's continuing to sign. As I walk over closer to him, he opens, he says, you know, I never mentioned your name, Mr. Jones. I needed someone to make a point, but I never mentioned your name. I hope you didn't mind what I said. And as I didn't say anything. I just walked up close to him. As I got close to him, I extended my hand, and I put my hand in his face, and I said, Dr. King, when do you want me to leave?
Soon we'll be done. Trouble of the world.
You're listening to Memories of the Movement.
If in our heart we do believe, Lord, we shall overcome, Lord, one day. We shall all have peace one day.
As a special events coordinator, Zenona Clayton worked closely with Dr. King and his wife, Coretta. Although he was always in imminent danger, she recalls the one time she believes that King was actually afraid.
He always said he was never afraid, and people often ask him, aren't you afraid? You know, things are pretty contentious down there in Birmingham or wherever they were going, and aren't you afraid? And he always said no, and I really believed him. But then he called one morning while I was on the trip with Mrs. King. And it was the same weekend of Bloody Sunday when they were going from Selma to Montgomery, that bloody, bloody march. And when he called to speak to Mrs. King, our procedure was, you know, I just kind of answered the phone. And then when I found it was he, then I would give the phone to her. So this was no unusual call. And I said, oh, hi, and we had an exchange. And I said, well, I'll get Coretta for you. He said, no, I want to talk to you first. He said, I'm on my way to Selma, and Andy and all the guys have called and said, please don't come. Said, these sheriffs are serious. They got big bully clubs. They are serious about stopping the march. They seem happy to kill somebody, and it's too tough right now. Please don't come. Well, he said, I am going to go, but I'm going to wait a moment till it cools off. He said, but I think this is one time I'm afraid. So I don't think I'm going to come back from Selma. So please promise me you'll take care of Coretta and the children and everything will be fine, because I don't think I'm going to make it back. And he said, but don't tell her, because I don't want to ruin her concert. She was getting ready for a concert that evening. He said, so don't tell her. So I got off the phone, and while he was talking to her, I said, oh, my gosh, to myself. I was so torn, like, well, I promised him I wouldn't tell her, but I cannot not tell her. And so I was torn between whether I should or should not. Well, as it turned out, he told her that he had told me that he really, really was afraid and that he loved her and didn't think he'd be back. Well, when we got off the phone, you know, she told me that. And it's so interesting that when we fast forward this story, she told many times to reporters and to people who interviewed her about him. They'd ask, was he ever afraid? She said, only once. And then she said to me one time, do you remember? And you look back, you were the one he told that he was afraid for the first time. Well, I remembered that for a long, long time, because that was the only time he was afraid.
King mentor and confidant, the Reverend Dr. Gardner C. Taylor, often verbally sparred with Dr. King over when and where violence could ever be justified. In this clip, Dr. Taylor, who passed away in April of 2015 at the age of 96, remembers their ongoing debate and how it shaped their friendship.
Dr. King and I did share delightful times together. We had a running discussion, debate, I won't call it controversy, about nonviolence. I was never really a strong believer in nonviolence. I believed in it as a tactical weapon, but as a way of life, I was never. I always believed that the Civil War should have been fought and the war against Hitler should have been fought. But at any rate, Dr. King and I used to discuss it, and I remember saying to him, asking, when does violence begin? Does it begin when a nonviolent person or nonviolent people provoke violence in someone? We never resolve that. And also, I raise the question often as to whether the driving out of the money changers in the temple by Jesus was an act of violence or nonviolence. Well, we had that kind of argument, and it was delightful discussing it. We never resolved it. He believed in it in nonviolence passionately. I believed in it rather as a tactic. I think those were incidents in our friendship that I remember vividly. And there were many others. Our relationship was not that of someone working with him in the civil rights movement, though I devoutly supported it and raised money in New York for it. But just we were just friends, and we swapped stories and had a great time together. I think that is the essence of it. I have always looked upon Dr. King as the, even his lightest moments, as the only authentic spiritual genius America has produced in all of its years. There was in him that spirit, and I enjoyed our relationship. I look to the day to see his dreams fully met. I think they are in part met now in our time, but I think the nation has to mature much more before the fullness of Martin King's life will be understood in this land.
Secretary of State Hillary Clinton recalls meeting Dr. King as a child growing up in Chicago. She says hearing his words helped her set her own moral compass.
I went to a sermon that he delivered at Orchestra Hall in downtown Chicago. Our minister asked if anybody in our youth fellowship group wanted to go, and we had to get permission. And I remember being surprised that Some of my friends' parents wouldn't give their children permission. They thought Dr. King was a rabble-rouser, that what did going to hear him speak have to do with coming together on Sunday night talking about the Bible? And I was so pleased that I got to go, and I remember that he gave a sermon that night about staying awake through the revolution. How do you, you know, see all the injustice around you, the discrimination, the inequality, and ignore it? And especially, how do you ignore it when all of a sudden people throughout America were waking up and saying, you know, we have to fix this. We can't be true to our country's ideals and values, and many of us can't be true to our faith if we aren't on the side of this revolution in attitudes and laws. And I remember waiting in a very long line to shake his hand. And so it was an incredible moment for me. And of course, I followed his, you know, his work in all of the years up until his assassination. And I often find myself, you know, reading, you know, what he said and how he said it, and really pricking the conscience.
Now, let me say this. The thing that we are challenged to do is to keep this movement moving. There is power in unity, and there's power in numbers.
Reverend Amos Brown is the pastor of the Third Street Baptist Church in San Francisco. He recalls how the difficult days of segregation often led to challenging confrontations.
The amazing and most incredible thing is that in Mississippi, in the late 50s, early 60s, whether you were 8 or 80, you were always considered a boy by white people. And one of my neighbors became very ill, and I had to ride in the ambulance with him. I was then about 16, and when I went into the emergency room with him, this young doctor comes out with the stethoscope in his hand and very jivingly says, "What's wrong with that boy?" And I looked at him and said, "Well, excuse me, what's wrong with you? Can't you see that's a man and not a boy? You should give him the respect of calling him a man." And he said to me, "I know what it is." And when he said that, I said, "Well, your insistence on calling him a boy or an it is just a byproduct of stupidity." And when I said that, immediately the nurse said, "Call the cops. This is one of these smart," she used the N-word, "Negroes." And when they came and saw who I was, they knew that I'd been involved in civil rights demonstrations. And the chief had come with him. And when he saw that I was the person who had caused all of this stir at that hospital, he said, "Well, what are we going to get him on this time?" And one of the other officers said, "Well, we should file the charges of using profanity in public." It was a profane thing in Mississippi in those days for a black man to be respected as a man. And I spent two nights in jail in Jackson. In fact, I still have my mugshot and the file of my arrest. This incident, along with several others, such as I was arrested for sitting on the same bench with white people at the zoo. Then I was arrested in Savannah, Georgia, for leading a wait-in at Tybee Beach in 1960. And in those days, black people could not swim, bathe on the beach. And I led a group of about 12 young people from the Savannah Youth Council to Tybee Beach. There was only one way into Tybee and one way out. And this is near Savannah. And really, I didn't know how to swim. And if those white people had created a ruckus there, and they had thrown me in that water, I've been a dead duck. But we stood our ground, and eventually the police came and arrested us. And I spent a night in jail at Tybee. This was in America in 1960, when we couldn't drink out of the same water fountains. We couldn't go to the same restrooms to relieve ourselves. You couldn't rent a room in a hotel. You couldn't try on clothes in a department store. Couldn't be buried in the same cemetery with white folks. This was the insanity that was pervasive in this nation 40 to 50 years ago, believe it or not. I lived through all of that. And little did I know that because of my being involved as president of the West Jackson Youth Council of NAACP and leading demonstrations during my high school days and later when I went to college at Morehouse, that the White Citizen Council of the state of Mississippi that spent millions of dollars to create a group called the State Sovereignty Commission, which was a spy group on all civil rights workers, including Medgar Evers and Martin Luther King. In 1987, Judge Barber ordered those files open. And though I knew that somebody was watching us, yet as a youth, as a child, I did not think that Mississippi was that threatened by me, that they would spend hundreds of dollars to have somebody following me, taking pictures of me all over this country, whether it was in Cleveland, Ohio, here in San Francisco, you name it, New York. They had these spies. And when Judge Barber ordered these files open, one of my young trustees in this church, Ralph Wheeler, a young lawyer, in fact, from Oakland, happened to have been down in Jackson. He's originally from Clinton, Mississippi, not far from Jackson. And when he read in the paper that these files were going to be open, he decided that he would go, realizing that I had been involved in the civil rights movement, and see if there was not a file on me. And when he went there and asked the curator of the files to see if there was a file on Amos Brown, lo and behold, it was discovered that they had this 12-page file on me. And the summation was given in the file that I had been arrested in Atlanta with Martin Luther King and Tybee Beach and at Livingston Park and at the Mississippi State Hospital there near Jackson, where I had this altercation with this young white doctor. And they closed the file by saying, Amos Brown is a full-fledged agitator, and we must keep a close watch on him. You know, it's unreal that even they had spies in the bank, the Deposit Guarantee Bank. And this one man, whose name I later found out was named Latham, a vice president of that bank, did the illegal thing of divulging to the mayor of the city and the chief of police that I had, as president of the West Jackson Youth Council of NAACP, opened a bank account for $47.80. And the notation was in this file, this source of the information must be kept confidential, and the person's name was blacked out. That was an experience that I shall never forget. And in later years, it was more frightening than then. In those days, I was too young and too daring to be scared. But just to think that in America, in the state of Mississippi, in the 50s and the 1960s, our privacy was so much invaded, and we were victimized by those race haters who lynched us, who kept us from going to quality schools, who would let us get jobs. And by the way, they also had a squad that went around to all the mass meetings. In fact, in that file, there is a listing of the license plates of cars owned by persons who attended mass meetings. And lo and behold, I saw there that 1955 Oldsmobile license plate of Mega Evers. In 1956, he brought me here to San Francisco in that old blue 55 Oldsmobile as president of the West Jackson Youth Council. I was only 15 years old then. And it was here at the convention that I first heard Martin Luther King Jr. speak. It was youth night. And by the way, Martin Luther King was only 26 years old then. A lot of people fail to realize and understand that he was not an old man when he led this movement. And he concluded that speech with such oratorical flights that I was so moved. I never shall forget his concluding words. And those words are now inscribed at the Yerba Buena Center here in San Francisco. I gave them to the artist who came and picked my brain about what kind of memorial should be fitting for Martin Luther King and what quotation, you know, really represented his oratory. And among other words I mentioned was his saying that he had the dream that the day would come when all of God's children, from base black to treble white, would be significant on the Constitution's keyboard. I never forgot that. And the other inscriptions that are around there, you know, let justice roll down like waters and righteousness as a perennial stream, from the book of Amos. It was from that text that I gave the artists the idea of that waterfall and Martin Luther King's words inscribed under the waterfall. So, 50 years later, America is still segregated. Racism is still alive, kicking, and doing well. Even Martin Luther King Jr. believed in affirmative action. A lot of folks misquote his oratory about, you know, being judged by the content of one's character and by not by the color of one's skin. Well, that was a vision. That was a dream. But the reality was, Martin Luther King Jr. said once in a speech, if America organized to do bad things against the Negro, it must organize to do good things for the Negro. That was affirmative action. And I am longing to see the day come when this nation would be done with this evil of bigotry and racism. We made some progress. We made some strides toward freedom, to use the words, the title of a book, the first book that Martin Luther King wrote. But we still have miles to go and promises to keep before we fall asleep.
You're listening to Memories of the Movie, a Tavis Smiley Show Black History Month special. I often say that life is not made up of the breaths we take, but of the moments that take our breath away. For those men and women who were part of the civil rights movement, there were many such moments, and now we continue to share a few of those special stories and reflections that we've compiled in this special Memories of the Movement.
We shall overcome.
Former New York Times reporter Earl Caldwell recounts his specific and altogether peculiar instructions from his editor in covering Dr. King's impending sanitation worker march in Memphis.
At that time, the New York Times, the editor of National News, was Claude Sitton. And he said to me, and giving me the assignment to come to Memphis, he said, Dr. King has got to be stopped. He said, if Dr. King is not stopped, he's going to cause a bloodbath. And these were his instructions. As a matter of fact, his final word to me was, and I want you to go down there and nail him. So he said, I want you to get down there a couple of days early. And secondly, wherever Dr. King stays, that's where you stay. On a story of this magnitude, it's very seldom that a paper will have an exclusive. But the New York Times, we knew we had a wide lead on this story. And so we were able to do things like open up phone lines. We were able to get all people on the phone, all these kinds of things. But when I called New York to tell them what had happened, I don't want to say that my editors knew, but when I got on the phone, they were ready. I mean, as a matter of fact, they held a plane at one of the airports in New York to bring a crew of seven, eight reporters to fly them in from Memphis. They had this team that was ready to go.
The gospel trains are coming, I hear it just at hand. I hear those car wheels rumbling and rolling through the land. Get on board, children, children, get on board, children, children, get on board, children, children. There's room for many a more.
One of our nation's premier advocates for children, Children's Defense Fund founder Marion Wright Edelman, got her start in the civil rights movement of the 1960s. Here she tells of her first visit to Mississippi, where she would later become the first African-American woman admitted to the state's bar.
A group of friends pooled money to get me from New Haven to Jackson, and Medica Evers picked me up at the airport, and he drove me home to have dinner with Merle and his children, and then he drove me, a first-year law student, a young person he didn't know, all the way up to Greenwood, Mississippi, which is where the SNCC headquarters was, to stay for a few days and to help register voters with Bob Moses and others who were there. But the first night we got to Greenwood, there was a shooting. And so the immediate reality of Mississippi sunk straight in. But then Medgar got me settled with the family, drove back home after we'd assessed the news of the shooting. And next morning I went out to the civil rights office where SNCC was. And I watched and remember Bob Moses trying to cajole people who were across the street, and they would come and be wooed by food and by other help that they desperately needed in that poor Delta County. But they were really terrified of coming across the street in light of what had happened. But they got enough of them got cajoled to come across the street and then to go down to register to vote, because Bob thought it was very important that these kinds of violent incidences not stop people and not be seen as deterrents. And I had promised my mother, and I had promised Morris McDougall, who was professor at Yale Law School, who was a Mississippian, who said I wouldn't have a prayer in hell of getting a Mississippi bar, almost anyway, but if I got arrested or got into trouble, no way. But anyway, I decided to walk behind them and not be a part of them, and so I went and joined this scraggly line of very courageous people, led by the SNCC workers and Bob Moses, down to the courthouse. And lo and behold, as we got there, there was this crowd of white mob, is what it was. But that's the first time in the South they brought out police dogs to attack civil rights demonstrators. And the police dogs scared people to death. And I just remembered Bob's courage. He stood there. I remember watching his pants be ripped off. I watched people begin to panic, and people that were on canes, and they were, you know, these were older people. And they got terribly scared, but Bob didn't move. It was just an extraordinary thing to watch. And the crowd of marches kind of scattered, and the SNCC kids threw me their keys to take back to the office as they were being hauled off to be arrested. And you looked around that square, and for the first time, I guess, I really understood the isolation that poor people in the South feel, because there was no place to look for help. And I remember one person I knew in the crowd, both there and at the courthouse, was Claude Sitton from the New York Times, but he wouldn't identify with me. And I saw a telephone booth, and I went and ran to it, and I called up John Doerr, whose name and telephone number I had, who was the Assistant Attorney General in the Civil Rights Division in Justice. And I remember him with his steely, calm voice as I was trying to describe this mob scene and the police dogs saying, just give me the facts. Stop all the emotion. Just give me the facts, Mary. Which I did. And I then immediately went back to the SNCC house and ran to the courthouse. The nearest black lawyer, we had three black lawyers in Mississippi at the time, were 90 miles away in Jackson, Mississippi. Brave people, never had gone to law school, had studied their way into the bar, and they were going to try the SNCC kids right away. And I remember trying to go up the front steps of the Greenwood LaFleur County courthouse with this mob of white people standing outside, and they wouldn't let me in the front door, so then I tried to go in the back door, and they wouldn't let me in the back door. But that's when I learned where I would practice law. And I knew I'd come back, and I was determined to get into the Mississippi bar. And but that was my earliest memory of Mississippi's justice. And I, to this day, will cross the street when I see a German police dog. And Dr. King and I used to laugh because he could always see how terrified he was, because they had German shepherds in the police car when they drove him from Atlanta out to the rural Georgia jail. And he allowed how terrified he was with his dog in the back. But that was my first real exposure as an adult to Mississippi justice.
I'm gonna be a registered voter one of these days, hallelujah. I'm gonna be a registered voter. I'm gonna be a registered voter one of these days.
Former Memphis sanitation worker Taylor Rogers, who died in 2012, recalled how racism led to the deaths of two co-workers in 1968 and became the tipping point for a strike and a march, which turned violent.
We just got tired, said we wasn't going to take no more. But the main thing that broke the story on the camel's back is when the two sanitation workers got crushed in this packer. They got up in that thing to get out of the rain, it was shaped like a barrel, and hit some kind of electrical switch and crushed them to death. The families didn't get no compensation. The families didn't get anything. So the men said, this is it. We're going to stand up. We ain't going to take no more. And we stood up. We told Henry Lowe, this is it. We're going to stand up. We're going to be men. And that's what we did. We stood up. And that's where the sign comes from, I'm a man. So we're not going back to work until we get organized and we start marching. And we marched every day for 68 days. And the first march that Dr. King came and we went violent. It was not the marches. Like they said before, I always said, I believe it was the FBI or some of those people that created that disturbance to discredit Dr. King because he was planning to march on Washington. And I don't think that the men didn't have, but once it got started, you know how things get started, and everybody fell into it. So, and that's why Dr. King vowed that he would come back to Memphis and have a nonviolent march.
Listening to Memories of the Movement, a Tavis Smiley Show Black History Month special. A collection of personal and poignant stories and reflections from icons of the Civil Rights Movement.
Now, Lord, be my friend. While I'm on this teacher journey, I want to.
As a close friend and lieutenant of Dr. King, Reverend C.T. Vivian participated in many of the major marches and events of the movement and recalls that there were many times his commitment to nonviolence was put to the test.
Encounter with Sheriff Clark in Selma, Alabama. Our goal was to win the right to vote, and we were after a voter's rights bill. And Selma was the city that we went to. We were asked to come. As director of affiliates, I had to go to be certain that we were being asked in. We never went into a place we were not asked into. And they had been in movement, but had not succeeded in doing what they wanted to do. So they called us in to see if we could help them succeed. And and so we did. But the affair itself, I'd led a group of about 40 people down to the courthouse in Selma, Alabama, because they wouldn't let us in the building to even try to vote. So we'd go up the steps, and then Sheriff Clark would come out with a group of policemen behind him, and he loved to look like Patton. He had pearl-handled guns and wore clothes that resembled that, and he was very showy kind of fellow, and he would come out and walk us back down the steps, but we'd be talking to each other all the time. I mean, not only to each other, we were talking, and I was doing most of the talking because he never had an answer. See, he would try to answer every now and then it would make him look bad, so he even almost stopped trying. But we got to the bottom of the steps in one of these encounters, because there were four or five such encounters, that he comes down the steps, and when he can't answer without looking bad himself, he turns his back on me as if to say, you don't matter. And the thing is, you could tell by his shoulders that he was playing a role. And so I said to him, Sheriff Clark, you can turn your back on me, but you can't turn your back on the idea of justice. And his shoulders just slumped. It was obvious, although behind him his shoulder slumped. He did not know what to do. He looked back over his shoulder. He didn't know what to say. And then we continued, and he finally couldn't hold it in any longer. And so he turned and he hit me, and down I went. And the man weighed about 250. And everybody behind me, you could hear, it was like a, like the wind went out of, and they moved back. I got up quickly because I wanted to make certain that the people behind me did not be discouraged by my being knocked down. And so I had to answer right quick. And so I said, what kind of people are you that you beat people because they desire to vote? in America? What do you tell your wife when you go home at night? What do you tell your children when you go home at night? And he couldn't take it any longer. And he said, arrest that man, arrest that man. And so a huge fellow came forward to arrest me. Most of the men in the city had been told by him that they had the right to arrest or do anything that he made the command for. So this fellow came forth. He's a huge man. He should have been playing in those days fullback for the Chicago Bears. And he arrested me. He took me over to the jail. We get to the jail, and the jailer had me to get on the elevator. And in those days, the elevators were quite old, and they were quite small. And this was a jail, and we're talking about the poverty of the Deep South. And there was no electric elevators then anyway, even if you went to the best of places. And this fellow asked to beat me. And the jailer looks at him as though, what's wrong with you? And the fellow was still asking to beat me. And he said, let me hit him just once. Let me hit him just once. And the jailer turned his head facing the elevator. I knew then I was going to get hit, because one white man very seldom tells another what he cannot do where a black man is concerned, very seldom ever. And so I knew what was coming. I start to put my hands behind my head to cushion the blow. I meant for them to come all the way, interlocked, interfaced, right? Catch the blow. But I didn't get that far. My fingers got just this far to where everything was even with my fingers. And that's when the blow hit. And I couldn't feel the end of my fingers for about 3 days. Afterwards, I thought, what if I had interlocked my fingers completely? The blow would have probably broken all my knuckles. But it was just right to catch the blow and not hurt me, except for my fingers. A blow like that could create a concussion. But we went upstairs. This big fellow threw me in the cell. And I thanked the Lord. You might think I thanked the Lord because I didn't get killed or something. That wasn't the issue. I was thankful to God that I had done what I was supposed to do, that I remained nonviolent through it all, that in fact he'd given me a chance to really get the message that we were about out to the whole world. I was thankful for the fact that what the purposes of the movement were being fulfilled, that these who were the enemy of everything that most of us hold decent was being shown to the world. I was extremely thankful. I fell down on this steel cot that was made to the wall, right? And just thank the Lord that things were like they should be. Most all of us were ministers on Martin's staff, except one or two women and a couple of other fellows. So this was what we were fighting for. See, they thought that we were fighting for a civil rights bill. We were more than that. Martin King's purpose was to redeem the soul of America. That's quite different. That was written on the window of SCLC when we first began, to redeem the soul of America. The real goals of SCLC, the real goals of the civil rights movement under Martin King has not been fulfilled and probably will not be fulfilled for some time. We're looking at a total King agenda. How long will it take? It doesn't matter as long as we're working on it. And as long as millions of people are working on it, individually as well as in groups and as well as in organizations, that's the end result.
You can catch me weeknights on my television show on PBS. For more info on what I'm doing or to hear this show, past shows, or the Tavis Smiley Show podcast, visit TavisSmileyRadio.com. Our producers are John Koch, Lachelle Sargent, Vanessa Rumbles, Tony Marcano, and Sonata Lee Narcis. Johnny Morris is our engineer, creative consultant, Denise Pines. Morris O'Kelly is our senior supervising producer. I'm Tavis Smiley. This is PRI. Keep the faith.